for 2.5 hours of Bathrobe Spears Broadsides on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Stay with us, stay tuned, and got lots of stuff coming.
Rockefeller, Campanella, Communist Bloc, Roy Khan, One for All, Toscanini, Dan Kron, Gin Gin, Foo Falls, Rock Around the Clock, Einstein, James Dean, Brooklyn's Got a Winning Team, Davy Crockett, Peter Pan, Elvis Presley, Disneyland, Bardo, Budapest, Alabama, Khrushchev, Prince's Place, Peyton Place, Trouble in the Suez.
We didn't start the fire.
Station is now in crisis, as those of you who have been kind of following the national news know. Free Radio Berkeley, the sort of the original station among micro-broadcasting stations since 1993, has been made the successful subject of a permanent injunction and is now off the air. The Free Radio Berkeley Collective met last night and decided to stay off the air for the time being. San Francisco Liberation Radio is also off the air. These are two very important key stations in the California Free Radio Network. Although, of course, we are still on the air, unlicensed and unrepentant, at 96.3 FM. That's what you're listening to this morning. This show concerns civil rights for the poor in Santa Cruz, in California, in the United States, and indeed across the globe. I've just returned from a long trip, not that long, a week, 10 days or so, and I want to thank the programmers Audio Cranium and Skidmark Bob, as well as any who helped them, for keeping Bathrobe Spears Broadsides on the air while I was out of town. They did, I understand, a good job. I'll have to review the tapes to see if I have any criticisms to make, but I really appreciate the help, and I hope that... Well, I'm feeling apprehensive about the future of free radio, but if our free radio station is, should we say, subject to attack by the FCC or their local minions, I'm hoping that the community will stand behind us and support us. That's really a key element of whether stations that are closed by the FCC reopen. For example, in Decatur, Illinois, there's actually a man whose station has been closed repeatedly. Well, he's quite a hero. He's gone to jail. His family has been his children were taken by CPS. His house was confiscated. All kinds of horrible things happened. We've actually talked about that in past broadcasts, not recently, but he's still broadcasting from Decatur, Illinois. In fact, he's one of the main stations in Decatur, Illinois, in spite of the FCC's determination to close down free speech for the poor on the airwaves. Here in Santa Cruz, of course, we've been broadcasting since 1995 here at 96.3. But all the help that you can give us is really essential at this time, really essential. If you have contributions financially, if you want to provide legal help, if you're interested in being around to simply lend a hand and witness in case federal agents invade the station, You can either give a call to the voicemail of Free Radio Santa Cruz at 427-4523. Contact us by email at frsc@cruzio.com. Or you can write us at P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz 95061. P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California 95061. And if you want to join me on the air today, we will have an open studio line. It's open right now at 423-5361. Our lines are open, 423-5361. So give us a call if you have anything you want to pass on. It's kind of ironic here in the studio. We have two clippings hanging from the wall, one from the City on a Hill Press from June 11th. Micro-movement, pirate radio struggles against the FCC and the National Association of Broadcasters. And there's a photo of one of our broadcasters, Reckless, here on the air. Well, I guess this was the last issue that the City on a Hill Press put out this year. Talked about how a 12-year-old girl stopped the FCC from coming into this station about a month ago. And now we learn that, last week on Tuesday, as you're going to hear in an interview with Free Radio Berkeley broadcaster Carol Denny and Free Radio Berkeley attorney Larry Hildes, the boom has fallen on the major free radio stations up north. Actually, the injunction only applies to Free Radio Berkeley at the moment, but it's a very serious shift of events, very serious situation for free radio stations throughout the country. And particularly those stations that have been visited by the FCC like we have and like others in San Jose have. Two San Jose stations were shut down last month, or actually they were intimidated into closing. They weren't actually forced to close by any legal order, but the FCC agents threatened and the people closed. When they threatened us, we said, go get a search warrant, and they haven't returned yet. But this new decision is a serious one. I actually have a copy of it here. It's an 18-page decision. I'm going to kind of look it over, but rather than read through all the tedious legalisms, what I will do instead, again, is let you hear directly from people concerned with the issue in Berkeley. First, you're going to hear from attorney Larry Hildes in Berkeley, and after that, you'll be hearing from activist and Free Radio Berkeley broadcaster and folk singer Carol Denny, who has often been on the air on my show, almost always from a distance, but she's great. She's got lots of important things to say. And in this case, stuff we have to listen to. Great updates and a crucial update on Free Radio Berkeley and its impact on this decision, the decision by federal judge Claudia Wilkin to permanently enjoin Free Radio Berkeley from broadcasting without a license. So let's listen to the situation in Berkeley as described by attorney Larry Hildes. He not only talks about the free radio situation, which as I said is a crucial one, and we are soliciting your support. Contact our voicemail at 427-4523 or call us in the studio and let us know you support what we're doing at 423-5361. Well, we're on the line talking to Larry Hildes, attorney at law and erstwhile activist. Larry, you just got out of an attorney's meeting around the Free Radio Berkeley stuff and the decision by Claudia Wilkin to grant, is it a permanent injunction or a preliminary injunction?
It is a permanent injunction pursuant to a summary judgment.
And I know that we're actually going to talk to you about other matters. Is there anything at all that you can say about that you think might be helpful for those of us down here who are wondering when the next shoe is going to fall?
It hasn't yet, and Free Radio Santa Cruz is not enjoined from anything. It might make it somewhat more likely that a raid might occur. Then again, it might not. Some of that, I think, is less of a legal and more of a political question. Mm-hmm. And, a tactical question. If there are a lot of people organized to protest and to defend the station, there's clearly community support for that station, they're much less likely to raid it, mm-hmm. in my opinion.
Do we know how many other stations have been raided since Wilkin's opinion?
None that I'm aware of, and they had been, but they had been doing that around the country, every place except here. It was possible, but mostly they have done it in places where the community was not organized.
Uh-huh. This decision came down, what, on Tuesday or Wednesday?
Tuesday at 3.
And Free Radio Berkeley then shut down on Wednesday and has been sort of caucusing to figure out what to do?
That is correct. It may still be caucusing as we speak. The lawyers have also been caucusing, and we are trying to decide, we're trying to come up with an effective strategy for affirmative legal action.
You talked, I guess, earlier about a possible 1983 action, which is what, an action for civil rights relief?
Yeah. An action against civil rights violations under color of authority.
Right, it's certainly a very colorful or colorless authority by the FCC.
Yes.
And I guess, there's mixed opinion on that. And then there's, but in this particular situation, what does the permanent injunction means that...
Basically, Stephen Dunifer and anyone acting in concert with Stephen Dunifer, and it is unclear precisely what that means, and the lawyers for Stephen Dunifer and Free Radio Berkeley are trying to get a clarification. And we'll be moving for reconsideration on that and some of the other issues. Anyone acting in concert is generally seen at this point as being Free Radio Berkeley. Must be quite a concert.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it is enjoined from operating, causing to operate, or taking any direct or indirect steps to cause to operate an unlicensed radio station. Extremely broad. Overly broad.
And this was granted because the main reason was that Dunifer had not gone through the formal process of applying for a license, correct?
Yes, which in my opinion is very silly, because there's no way you would have gotten a license. It would have been expensive to apply, and you were not required under one of my favorite cases, and one that we cited in Santa Cruz, Shuttlesworth v. Birmingham, which says that you do not have to apply for a license or for a permit for a demonstration, and it's specific to that, but not necessarily specific to that, when the regulations are so difficult to follow, that, or when when they're judged arbitrarily, and thus applying for a permit is futile.
So the nature of the regulations has been, and I guess you were talking to me about this earlier, that the cost of a normal application for a license would be $2,500 to $3,000 for the application itself, a required engineering survey of $25,000 to $30,000, and then a proof that 1 year's worth of operational funds is in the bank, which would be $40,000 to $60,000, I guess, depending on the size of the station, how much the cost would be, probably be less for small micro stations. But it would be somewhere around $100,000 or perhaps $50,000 if operational expenses were much less.
Right.
And so this would be prohibitive. But the claim was, I guess, the Judge Wilkins said that there was a waiver provision that could have been used and has been used in the past that would have allowed people to get a license in spite of these concerns, and that the issue was moot because no application had been made, and that waiver might have happened had that application been made?
Right. Never mind the fact that there have only been two waivers granted.
Two waivers in how long?
The act was passed in 34.
So that's in 64 years.
There may have been some granted during and around the time of World War II, but certainly nothing in recent years.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that the two waivers involved one, a Denali station 100 miles from the nearest other station, and another, a station in Alaska, similarly distant.
Right, way out in the middle. Yeah, out in the Arctic, basically.
By a waiver, do you mean that they did not force them to get engineering surveys and put up lots of money, or do you mean that they gave them a license even though they were less than 100 watts, which since, I guess, 1980 was 82 or 81, or has been itself a bar? You've got to have at least a 100-watt station?
Right. I believe that it's the latter, but I'm not sure. I don't know if they were required to do the engineering surveys and the rest of that.
Uh-huh.
But I know they were granted a waiver so they could operate at less than 100 watts.
Uh-huh. Well, would it have been, is it, what, do you think it was an error on the part of Dunifer, Stephen Dunifer, the Free Radio Berkeley, well, I should say the collective, not to apply for formally for a waiver?
In my opinion, no. I don't believe it would have made any difference. I believe it would have been a waste of money.
Well, they couldn't have used the argument, or Claudia Wilkin could not have upheld the argument if they hadn't applied formally. They would have applied formally.
True. And I can't speak to Stephen's politics, but my reading would be that it is prohibitively expensive for every one of these stations, $2,500 or $3,000, to apply for something that they know they're going to get denied on.
So, in other words, even to apply for a station is going to cost a micro station at least $2,500 to $3,000 simply to put the form on the desk of the FCC?
That is correct.
So, in essence, what Claudia Wilkin was telling the Free Radio Berkeley was, you have to spend this amount of money to even begin the process, regardless of how poor you are.
Right. Poor people need not apply to have access to the airwaves.
So, are you saying, can't the argument be made, or maybe perhaps was Wilkin making the argument that you could have gotten a waiver for that fee itself, and you could have applied for a waiver for the initial fee?
For a waiver of that fee.
We know that for sure?
Well, to my knowledge, there is no waiver of that fee. Generally speaking, those kind of regulatory fees, there is not a waiver for.
Mm-hmm.
What it in essence is saying, it was a way of getting around having to deal with the constitutional issues.
The constitutional issues being, briefly,
First Amendment issues, right to access to the airways, right to access to free speech.
Mm-hmm.
Whether the FCC has a right to restrict that. For example, they do not have a right to restrict the number of newspapers that exist in an area.
Mm-hmm. But of course, the claim has always been that given the existing band length, and I guess you pointed out that the bands could be expanded below 88 and above 108 FM, but that at the moment they're not.
But there's also plenty of room on them. And you're talking about a station that on a really good day managed to reach across the Bay Bridge into Chinatown. On a really good day.
From Berkeley. Were there many complaints of interference? Here in Santa Cruz, our station has occasionally had complaints that it's interfered with other stations.
I'm not aware of any. And they intentionally picked a bandwidth that nobody else was using. And there are plenty of those available at this point.
So what penalties does Free Radio Berkeley face if they defy the FCC, or let's say go on the air again, perhaps claiming they're not defying the FCC, but the FCC claims they're being defied?
Well, individuals doing, first of all, the equipment could be confiscated.
Mm-hmm.
Equipment is probably replaceable.
Mm-hmm.
Individuals face two forms of penalty. First of all, they could be charged, as they always could have been, for violation of the Communication Act, which is a felony,
mm-hmm.
and prosecuted. Secondly, they could be hauled in for violating the injunction. Then the FCC has to prove that they were served with the injunction, or at least on notice of the injunction, which is difficult. Second, they have to prove that they were acting in concert with Stephen Dunifer, who right now is someplace else in the country,
mm-hmm.
and has resigned from Free Radio Berkeley and all the committees he was on.
I see, so as to avoid the poison touch, eh?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So they would have to prove that they were acting in concert with him. Then those individuals could be subjected to either civil or criminal contempt proceedings and could face jail time and or fines.
Now, we're talking, this is after a jury trial or a trial before a judge?
Criminal contempt, at least you get a jury trial. I believe you do in civil also when there's actual threat of jail time.
I think in Santa Cruz it had to be less than five. I think you'd be jailed for 5 days before a judge without, at least in state contempt cases.
Yeah, it may very well be 5 days. It's 5 days in many places.
According to your colleague David Beauvais down here, he says 6 months triggers it. It triggers a jury trial in federal cases.
Oh, okay.
So let's get on. I mean, is there more? I'm sure there's a lot more to be said about the Free Radio Berkeley situation, but we still don't know. It's as if we're talking now. It's 6:45 on Saturday evening, and we're waiting for to get the word from Free Radio Berkeley as to what's happened. I think they actually have broken up, but we haven't been able to get through to Carol Denny, who's the woman we've been trying to reach. But you also have another case pending. You have filed a federal lawsuit for civil rights violations regarding abusive behavior by police in Humboldt County?
That is correct.
Uh-huh. What's that all about?
I was up in Humboldt County doing legal work for Earth First and people defending Headwaters Forest, as I have for several years. I've done criminal cases for people up there who've been arrested at demonstrations. I've done police abuse cases in federal court here for people who were abused while being arrested during demonstrations. And apparently was on the list that they had of people they wanted to arrest. And they had missed me on November 15th, 96, when they went looking for the leadership and grabbed people for failing to leave a demonstration that they were leaving.
This was an Earth First demonstration, or?
So September 15th, 97, I was there coordinating a group of legal observers at a demonstration that ended up at the Newburgh Road gate to Headwaters Forest. And I had my camera and my legal pad and was taking notes and taking pictures of the cops and generally keeping track of that and keeping track of a team of people who I had trained who were doing the same.
Mm-hmm.
As the day went on, the cops began to get more restless, and the head of security for Pacific Lumber arrived somewhere around 4 o'clock. And they had a meeting, and almost immediately after that, they gave a order that people had to disperse in 10 minutes or chemical agents would be used. And they had bandoliers with tear gas grenades and so on.
Uh-huh.
And I had been noticing, and other people had been noticing all day, that people were up dancing, you know, behind the police line, dancing on the road to Headwaters and putting up barriers and so on. Some of them were arrested. They weren't filmed. Most of the, or one of the sheriff's videographers at least, was concentrating on filming me. And I was never doing anything very interesting. I was taking pictures and taking notes and talking with people. Nothing very exciting.
Mm-hmm. Were you in an area which was illegal or out of bounds? Had you been warned to leave?
Nope. I was on public road where everybody else was.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, there were two lines of cops making sure that one, other than the people who snuck all the way around them, that nobody could cross the line. It was impossible to cross the line effectively.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a group of demonstrators sitting in front of the line. And they were still on public property, and they were moved a few times. They gave a 5-minute dispersal order, and I was asking, and some of the other people were asking, where can we disperse to? When they, first of all, they're not supposed to give you, declare a demonstration illegal assembly unless there is violence taking place, basically. It's not an unlawful assembly unless there's some violence or similar conduct going on. There is none.
Did they allege any later?
No.
Mm-hmm.
But they ordered people to disperse, and we asked to where, because they have to give you a distance that you can go, a place that you can go to. The response came in when they gave the 5-minute warning. It was, go home. There is no place you can demonstrate here. It's over.
Well, that's interesting, because it reminds me of the, in the Watts riot of 1964, a police officer apparently came upon a number of black demonstrators, or perhaps they were looters, who knows, but they were there, and he started shouting to them, go home, go home, at which point the voice from the back came, we are home, Whitey. In any case, proceed.
Good answer.
So anyway, you were told to go home, and you said, I'm homeless, or you said, what do you, my home is in Berkeley, but it's a ways away, or?
I think I yelled something like that. My home is 300 miles away, what am I going to do? But lots of people responded. I was not particularly loud in responding to that one.
And the police then began arrests, or what happened?
Well, they made a 2-minute warning. As they made a two-minute warning, as we discovered watching the Sheriff's Department's own videotapes, the videographer for the Sheriff's Department was filming me while he was hiding in the woods. I was still in the street.
Were you the only attorney present, or...?
Katya Komisarek from the Guild had been present for most of the day. She had left because her back was bothering her. So she was gone.
And had she been filmed as well?
I don't know. I didn't see much film of her, but I don't think they necessarily would have known who she was. Uh-huh. They knew who I was.
How did they know who you were?
Well, as they were filming this, somebody approached the videographer, and we still don't know exactly who, and said to him, when you arrest him, make sure you get it all on film. He's your number one priority, because he's the lawyer who represents those scum.
And how do you know this was said? This was on film?
You hear it on their videotape.
Hmm, that's convenient.
Yes, they're smart people.
I see.
Anyway,
have you ever heard of the 18-minute gap?
Fortunately not.
Yeah.
Well, they were whispering, so I don't know if they realized that they were being heard. I'm sure they had intended not to be.
Mm-hmm.
Sure enough, they gave a one-minute warning. People started to leave. I started to leave. Went on down the road. The time expired. And, you know, I was by then about 100 feet away from the line. The police went over, around, through, every way they could, by the people who were refusing to leave, took off down the road, after specific people who were leaving.
Uh-huh.
And they grabbed someone across the road from me. I took a quick picture and ran.
Uh-huh.
And they came at me, and a cop approached me, and I attempted to move out of his way so he could go do whatever he was doing. And instead, he grabbed me, and I said, what are you doing? I was getting out of your way.
And his response was?
I don't remember what his response... I believe his response was, you're under arrest.
And what did he charge you with?
Failing to disperse, failing to leave the scene of a riot, failing to disperse when ordered to do so, resisting arrest. And this was interesting. Sure enough, they were there perfectly, you know, perfectly set up, filming everything that happened to me. He slammed me into a car, then slammed me into the bushes, pulled my camera out of my hand, somewhere in that process, dislocating one of my fingers, pinned me to the ground. Two cops pinned me to the ground. One of them, in what's obviously staged for the camera, is yelling over and over again, quit resisting, you know, four times in quick succession, quit resisting, quit resisting, quit resisting, quit resisting.
And are you shown on the camera as resisting?
I am shown on the camera pinned face down on the ground. Unable to resist in any way.
Were you moving your little finger?
I wasn't moving anything.
I see. Well, let's go ahead then. So you were, were these charges dropped?
No.
But they're still
changed. So they took us to jail. They took my camera. They took seven rolls worth of pictures.
Have they returned it yet?
Yeah, they returned them after making copies. They took my legal notes, which they returned after Xeroxing. I spent 3 days in jail. I was charged, you know, I was charged with resisting. I was charged with the failure to leave the scene of a riot and refusal to disperse, failure to disperse. Got to the jail, was booked in, and all of a sudden, you know, go into court 2 days later, and I am charged with battery on a cop. Who, by the way, never alleged any battery in his police report.
An unlawful touching. Were you kissing him, perhaps?
Not a chance.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Resisting arrest and trespass on private land with intent to damage it. It's funny because I was never trespassing. I was never on private land.
Hmm. So these charges were filed way back in the fall of last year?
They were filed in September. I had to be bailed out on $10,000 bond. Someone put up $1,000 for me. And in cash, and I was released, and they went through with prosecuting this up until we got the videotapes, and David filed a motion to dismiss for selective prosecution. Very interesting. They had grabbed a bunch of people. They grabbed people with video cameras. They grabbed people with still cameras. They grabbed me. And they finally, 45 minutes after doing that, they had a discussion and decided, yes, they would arrest the people who were refusing to disperse, having arrested a bunch of us who were dispersing for failure to disperse. In the midst of that, they let this one woman just get up and dance around for a while and then wander away. Mm-hmm. On the third day we were in, they released everyone except me and this one woman who was videotaping. Without charges.
Uh-huh.
Two of us they charged. So we filed a motion for motion to dismiss for selective prosecution.
How many people were actually at the scene how many demonstrators were there up there or observers combined?
At the high point several hundred. By the time they started busting people, 200 probably.
And so of all those hundreds of people, of whom how many were arrested?
I don't actually know. Something like 60, I believe.
Of the maybe 60 arrested, only two were charged, and you were one of those two?
They did not charge the people who were trespassing, and they did not charge the people who allegedly refused to disperse.
And your attorney, David Beauvais, then filed what, for dismissal on the basis of selective prosecution?
Yeah, and included the videotape as the exhibit.
And what was the response of the district attorney to that?
He immediately moved to drop charges.
So their net charges are no longer pending.
That is correct.
And instead, you are in fact suing them for damages.
Oh yeah.
And what? Where does that? When did that happen? And what's that all about?
We filed in. I'm trying to even remember when it was now.
Actually, I saw your name in the paper in a small blurb in the Examiner. I think it was two or three weeks ago, maybe a month ago.
Yeah, we filed on May the 9th. Or May the 8th.
And what kind of damages are you seeking?
Billions.
I see. So naturally, I'll get my 10%. Well, so when is this case likely to go to trial? In 2045? Or?
A year or two down the road from now, if it goes to trial.
And you're thinking that a settlement may be in the offing?
Not yet. I should let David know that there is a letter from the DA's office of Humboldt County in his box. Contents unknown.
Aha. Uh-huh. Possibly a death threat.
It's very short. It's very small, whatever it is. But let me put it this way. I think if they're smart, they'll settle.
Now, were you pepper sprayed?
No. And they never actually used the chemical weapons that they were threatening. And in fact, they had not received authorization to use pepper spray yet. But they had what appeared to be CS gas. Nobody was sprayed.
But you said that you did suffer physical injury.
Yeah, one of my fingers was dislocated. I have various cuts and bruises. I had to have somebody pop the finger back into place. And I asked for medical attention while I was in jail. And the nurse, who was a very sweet human being, compared that finger, which was my right ring finger, with my left middle finger, and said, oh, they're the same size. There's no injury. It took me 2 days to get aspirin. Finally, on the evening of the second day, I got ice, and that helped. No other treatment. They refused any other treatment. They denied there was anything wrong. My finger was obviously quite swollen.
In essence, because you had given them the finger, they just denied you treatment.
I suppose so.
So, if people are following this case, I guess that if there isn't a settlement, there'll be a trial in a couple of years.
We've filed, they have an answer due by the 30th of this month. And we're interestedly awaiting that to see what it is.
Now, I saw that regarding another case you probably don't know much about, but that your colleague David Beauvais, who's with us here, says, I don't know if you're involved in this, David, or not, but you may remember there was a large lawsuit against, I think it was the city of San Francisco, for holding people after the Rodney King demonstration.
I know quite a lot about that case.
Well, we found that, I guess about that, there was a recent announcement that the settlements had finally been reached and people were getting, what, $4,000 each?
They settled for $1 million flat and changes in the training program and policy.
But I think that boils down to $2,000 or $3,000 or $4,000 apiece per demonstrator.
Yeah.
And some hefty amount for the lawyers. And the reason I mention this is because one of our now deceased protesters, Linda Edwards, was a defendant in that case. Naturally, we're trying to haul in the booty over her dead body, so to speak. perhaps for her estate or for her relatives, although we don't know where we could find them. But I guess this is a subject for another discussion. Is there anything you want to say on Free Radio Santa Cruz before the feds come knocking at the door?
Well, I'm not allowed to advocate illegal activity as a lawyer, but as an activist, I'm glad you all are there. Well, not to say anything about what you should do, but I think low-power community radio stations serve a real community need, and I'm glad you're there.
Well, I'm glad you're fighting your own case because, in, of course, asserting your rights, you speak for the rights of many of those who are unable to or haven't got the resources to assert them. Larry Hildes.
And you are tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. Just been listening to an interview between me and attorney Larry Hildes of Berkeley, who's one of the team of lawyers who are helping Free Radio Berkeley. We're going to be hearing more about Free Radio Berkeley shortly from activist and broadcaster Carol Denny, who we spoke with this morning, or was it last night, in any case, within the last 12 hours, again, about the results of a long meeting yesterday afternoon by the Free Radio Berkeley Collective, which initially met with some of the attorneys, and Larry Hildes was one of those attorneys, about the turn of events that happened, I guess, on Tuesday, when federal judge Claudia Wilkin unexpectedly upheld a permanent injunction against Free Radio Berkeley. And I'm going to try to kind of review the document I have here, the document filed June 16th, USA versus Stephen Paul Dunifer. He's the Free Radio Berkeley grand old man who apparently now is traveling. He has disassociated himself from Free Radio Berkeley so as to give them more leeway in terms of what they can do, since this is his, the U.S. is versus him. And, the struggle continues. We're also going to be, I'm not going to be playing an interview on the subject, but San Jose has some interesting developments happening today. At 5:30, there's going to be a meeting. Coming into town is going to be a caravan from the Kensington Welfare Rights Union, which I talked to some of those folks a year or two ago. They're kind of an outspoken group of poverty-fighting radicals in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. They've chartered a bus. They're going all over the country seeking information about human rights violations on this, the 50th anniversary of the signing of the UN Declaration of Human Rights. And I think we have some details on it. I'm looking through these faxes that I just got and don't see too much that's helpful on here, but there is some information I got from Lennox of Food Not Bombs in San Jose. Food Not Bombs in San Jose feeds, I think it's either once or twice a week. I think it's actually only once a week now on, Saturday afternoon at St. James Park. And this evening at 5:30, the Kensington Welfare Rights Union, this is what Lennox told me, is going to arrive at the First Christian Church in San Jose. That's also the headquarters for the Community Homeless Alliance Ministry, run by Scott Wagers and Nancy Nichols, who have successfully opened up shelter space for homeless people, sometimes by negotiating, sometimes by protesting, sometimes by civil disobedience of a peaceful sort. They are hosting this tour, which has 25 stops in the country, and I guess the Kensington Welfare Rights Union bus stops first in San Francisco, then comes down to San Jose to stop between 5 and 6. Food Not Bombs is going to provide a meal in San Jose at 5:30 at the First Christian Church, which, again, for those of you who want to go to it, is at 80 South 5th Street in San Jose, 80 South 5th Street. And I think I'm going to be going to this event later today, and I probably have room for one or two people in my car, assuming it's still running at that time. If anybody's interested in going to this event, give me a call at 423-HUFF, HUF 423-4833. HUF is an acronym for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, which is a civil rights organization concerned with the rights of homeless and poor people. And we're going to be going over, as I said, to San Jose to have a Food Not Bombs meal, and then to talk with the Kensington Welfare Rights Union people. This is again on the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Human Rights. Apparently they are gathering documentation for a community tribunal in each city to expose human rights violations by presenting living testimony of the suffering caused by poverty. And today, Sunday, June 21st, in San Jose, that's going to be happening. I guess we'll be leaving here probably around 4:30. So if you're interested, I do give a call to 423-HUF, and we'll give you more details on where we can all get together and meet. There's going to be an open mic over there in San Jose. If you have some documentation about violations of your rights that you want to present to the Kensington Welfare Rights Union so they can present it to the United Nations. And this isn't just sort of a stunt, although, you know, it certainly is being done to publicize the human rights problems. But people like Jennifer Wagoner, homeless rights activist in Santa Monica, has been compiling information in her town on human rights violations to give to the UN's Keith McHenry of Food Not Bombs, who you'll hear later on the show. We did an interview with him last night as well. Has also, through Food Not Bombs, other members of that organization have been compiling and brought to the United Nations concerns about the criminalization of the poor. My case, when I was in jail for a month back in 1996 for feeding people in front of Civic Center Plaza in San Francisco, rice and beans, that was brought to the United Nations and is still in one of their subcommittees. So the United Nations is a forum to really consider abuses that are being ignored or supported by authorities in this country. And it's something you might consider looking into if you have time and you want to go over to San Jose today and talk to some folks who've been going from city to city in a bus. I don't think they're coming to Santa Cruz. At least I haven't heard that. I think I would have if they were. So this may be the only opportunity to talk to them. So getting back, however, to the main crisis of the moment, which is the attempt of the Federal Communications Commission and its minions, I should say, the local police in different cities, to shut down poor people from using the airways, which should belong to all of us, which do belong to all of us. That is happening in Berkeley today. There is no Free Radio Berkeley broadcasting. There is no San Francisco Liberation Radio broadcasting. You are quite fortunate to be able to be hearing Santa Cruz, Free Radio Santa Cruz today, because it is directly endangered by the decision to enjoin Free Radio Berkeley. We have not been taken to court, but not only could we be at any time, we could be raided, as other stations have been throughout the country, on the flimsiest of pretexts, or no pretext, because now that the case that had long kind of held back federal, one might even say, Gestapo in California from attacking the radio stations here, that decision is gone. There was, for 3 years, Stephen Dunifer held back. And Stephen Dunifer, his legal help, and the Free Radio Berkeley Collective, with the help of Judge Claudia Wilken, Federal Judge Claudia Wilken, held that there were real First Amendment issues that had to be resolved before a radio station could be closed down, forced to get a license that would cost thousands and thousands of dollars. $100,000, you heard in this interview with Larry Hildes. Well, that is now gone by the boards. Claudia Wilken has essentially collapsed. Was it under political pressure? Was it because she wants a federal judgeship and the higher court? I guess the Court of Appeals. Was it because she had a change of mind? We don't know. But she didn't even reach the First Amendment issues about whether there should be a process for poor people to be on the air even if they don't have $100,000. Provided they're not interfering with other radio stations, provided there is ample space. All these issues have been essentially ignored and cast aside. But that doesn't stop the merry band of Free Radio Santa Cruz folks from continuing to put out what they feel is important information, and I should say scores, if not hundreds, of free radio stations across the country are still continuing to broadcast and determined to make their voices heard. And indeed, it's not simply a phenomenon in the United States. In places like Chiapas and Guatemala, in little third world countries, Stephen Denifer's cheap radio kits, and that's a part of it. He has put together cheap radio transmitters for less than $1,000 that people can use in small villages to challenge totalitarian or militaristic or fascistic government propaganda and spread the word and organize the communities. That's happening throughout the world. And it's not going to stop happening because one federal judge takes a dive or makes a bad decision. But let's hear more about what Free Radio Berkeley is doing. Let's hear the word from activist Carol Denny in Berkeley on that subject.
Thank you. Anything more you want to add?
That's everything.
June 20th, 10 o'clock in the evening, call to Carol Denny. Well, on the line with us here this evening is Carol Denny, the folk singer, activist, and general air-do-well of Berkeley.
Hi there, Carol.
Hello! Hello, everybody.
And Carol, you've not only been, you've been out there, I guess, throughout the afternoon, you've been powwowing with Free Radio Berkeley broadcasters?
Yes. Well, actually, we had a big meeting that was listed. We had people from the community and listeners and some fans showed up, so it wasn't the people there were all kinds of people concerned about Micropower and interested in being of assistance because we're certainly at a point of change with our project.
And, of course, that is because of the injunction, right?
June 16th, the FCC was granted a long sought-after injunction by Claudia Wilson, the judge in our case, and so we are officially enjoined from broadcasting as of, we're presuming, that date. So we did go off the air at that point so that we could have a powwow and consider...